Apologize for the delay. I just want to say, first of all, that, of course, all of our hearts and prayers go out to those in Las Vegas who were victims of a mad person. I refuse to say that person's name, but we are very concerned about what is going on there. And, of course, the recovery efforts in Puerto Rico, and not forgetting the folks in South Florida or Florida, as well as Texas. That said, we have a full agenda. I have promised not to make this a record, breaking the last record that was set for Board of Public Works. So with that in mind, I'll turn it to the treasurer.
Good morning. I don't know there's much I could add, except we live in tragic times, and I'm sure that we each, in our homes and in our communities, working with neighbors and families, are doing what little we each can do to help out the community, both immediately here and in other parts of the world and America. It is interesting, perhaps one little bright ray of sunshine is that more people realize now that Puerto Rico is in fact part of the United States of America.
And
it's news, but that hardly makes up for the tragedy and the madness of that shooter.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, Governor, it's a beautiful day here.
Really is.
The start of the most beautiful season in my mind, and we're very fortunate to be here.
When I lived in California for a good period of time, I missed the fall. That's what I miss.
You know, actually, my folks moved back here from the San Francisco Peninsula after about 4 or 5 years because they missed the change of seasons.
Yeah, missed the fall. Because it's in Southern California, it's spring and summer. Basically, spring and summer, because it grows all year round. So, you know, I remember when I came back and it was cherry blossom time. My dad was talking about, oh, you're going to go see the cherry blossoms? I said, you know, the cherry blossoms are really because winter is over. You know, I was living in L.A. Winter's never winter unless you go to the mountains. So,
thank you. Thank you, Governor and Treasurer. I was in California a couple of weeks ago. And I said to someone, it was a day just like this. And I said, boy, it's really nice weather. And their response was, yeah, just like the 90 last days.
Yes.
Exactly like it. So I like the variety. I agree with the treasurer. And I would like to echo the sentiments, Lieutenant Governor Rutherford and Madam Treasurer, that you just made about the horrific tragedy that occurred in Las Vegas 3 days ago. I'd like to convey my sincerest sympathies to the victims and the families whose lives were impacted by this senseless act of violence and hatred. Like so many Americans who woke up Monday morning to this heartbreaking news, it was difficult to watch the video footage and listen to the gut-wrenching reports from the massacre that has killed at least 59 people and wounded more than 500, including 27-year-old Tina Frost from Crofton, who was shot in the face, lost an eye, I believe is still in a coma. I see County Executive Hsu here, and I see the Mayor of Annapolis also, and obviously coming from Anne Arundel County, everything that they have said about Tina being a soccer star and a leader in this county and in this state, we wish her a speedy recovery. But I do think that we as a society simply have to do better. We have to rise above the partisanship and once and for all address what can only be described as an epidemic of gun violence unique to the United States that has killed tens of thousands of our fellow Americans. To be sure, Congress needs to stop dragging its feet and finally pass comprehensive gun laws that enact common sense reforms, restrictions, and requirements to keep our community safe. And anybody who listened to those tapes, I spent a couple of years in the Army, but that was machine gun fire. Really? That was not... that was the... that's something out of Vietnam. So we need to do gun control, but there's a second part of this argument, which if we don't do, if we don't address it, I think we can't get the problem completely covered. And that is that we need to get serious about the grossly inadequate mental health services that plague so many of our communities. Because absent of a robust, accessible, and viable mental health care system in this country, we're never going to be able to truly say that we're doing our best to prevent future tragedies like Las Vegas, like Orlando, like San Bernardino, like Sandy Hook. My wife, Annie, and I continue to mourn and pray for all those who died and those who were wounded from this unexplainable tragedy. It's my sincere hope that the horrific events in Las Vegas will inspire our nation to work together and inspire our federal lawmakers particularly to join and come together to prevent these tragedies from happening again in the future. And Lieutenant Governor, thank you for letting me say that.
Thank you. Well stated, and I really appreciate your point about mental health. That is a major issue, and actually one of the items in the agenda, I'm going to ask a question on that, but we'll wait. Sorry, one looks at how many tabs I have. In
the lack of necessity for machine guns and automatic guns to be circulating around in our community. The comptroller in a former life was a great advocate and leader in gun control. Good to see that.
Okay. Well, Madam Secretary.
Good morning, Governor. I would like to say there's something you read about in newspapers all the time, and you know how terrible it is, but my family lived next door to Tina Frost for 19 years, two doors down from Tina Frost, and my daughters played with Tina Frost and her sister Megan Frost for years, and I have lots of pictures of this little girl, so I'm very glad that Tina is alive, but it is really shocking when, you know, it is... your next-door neighbor for 19 years. All right, so all good karma to Tina Frost out in Las Vegas and her family, though, in Arundel County and the state of Maryland. We have 15 items on the Secretary's agenda. We have 4 reports of emergency procurements. We are prepared to take your questions.
I have one question about items, just an education for me. Items 6 and 10.
Okay, I don't know.
They're loan forgiveness. Maybe I don't even need them answered right now. The loan for forgiveness under the drinking water revolving program.
Please, Secretary Buell.
I do think the Secretary Buell's here. I didn't know if
maybe we need to bring the question back to.
I can. I was waiting for your question, but I mean, Secretary. Buell is here. We can take this.
I also have Wally. I would like to say with some sorrow that our very excellent manager of the Water Quality Financing Program, Jack Kuhlman, retired last week.
Was
a tremendous asset to the department and a deal maker in a good way. So I mourn him right now. Wally can answer some questions if you'd like to.
Let me tell you a little story. I went with the World Bank for a subnational debt conference in Chengdu, China, little China, a couple weeks ago, and they were talking about general obligation and revenue debt. And there was a fellow who was the head of the Revenue Debt Association or something like that, America. And he started talking about Maryland's program and JAG.
Oh, my God.
In Chengdu, China, to representatives of the 31 provinces of China, and about how terrific JAG is. And I broke the news to him, and he was devastated and said his entire professional community would be. And I said, well, we are, too. Not that there's not a great future, but JAG is just a tremendously brilliant, talented guy.
Right.
And but I'm sure this is a question that you all can answer. If not now, later.
Okay.
These are both loans to local communities for very worthy projects under the State Water Revolving Loan Fund.
Mm-hmm.
And the counties have to pay back at an interest rate of 25% of the average of the bond buyer 11 bond index for the month preceding the loan closing. And on number 6, Harford County pays back 0.8 what amounts to 0.8% interest over up to 30 years. And in 10, Prince George's County pays back 0.7% over 30 years. It's a little difference, but over 30 years it can add up to significant sums. And I'm just curious, since they're both on the agenda at the same time.
Yes,
yeah, sure. This is Waleed Safari.
I manage the Engineering Capital Projects Program. The reason you have different interest rates and also include loan forgiveness, it's all based on determining whether the community, the service community, is a disadvantaged community, and we decide that by several factors, the median household income, the unemployment rate, if it's higher than the state, and also, like in the example of Harford County, there, after calculating the user rate after the project, if it goes above 1% of the median household income, then we provide an additional subsidy in order to mitigate the impact on the user rate. So it's mainly based on the determine whether the community is disadvantaged or not.
So it's despite the fact it says that an interest rate of 25% of the average bond buyer rate, it really isn't that. It's that is a base, and then that's
that, that's the base. So the actual rate would be 0.7%.
Well, I would suggest this doesn't make that clear. I get the concept.
Yeah.
I have no problem with the concept, but this language doesn't make this language makes it look as though the only thing I could figure out is somehow they closed at different times. We're just reported.
Well, I actually
at the same
think that
time.
I think that the first sentence is what I've always gone on these items, that they will repay it at the 25% of the average of the bond buyer 11 bond index.
Right.
That subsequent sentence in both of them seems to be a description that has nothing to do with the item. It says, based on this formula, recent loan recipients have received a 0.8 or 0.7. It seems like there's just an inconsistent thing there because
yeah.
what have the recent loan recipients?
Right.
But that's not the statement of what their interest rate is going to be at all. It's that 11 bond buyer, 11 bond index, which I guess he's telling us is not actually accurate.
It's mostly an estimate based on what we have, based on the current rate, but the rate can change between now and closing the loan.
Well, is
slightly.
There some way that we can be notified at close of what the actual rate is so that the record is clear?
Sure. After the loan closing, we can notify you that what was the actual rate.
Because I think it's I'm not saying it's intentionally misleading,
yeah.
but
yeah.
It's
close to the – this is going to be upon closing, we don't expect the interest rate to change significantly. So this it's going to be close to that number.
Maybe just a quarterly report bringing us up to date. Because we approve of these
sure.
quite often.
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, even with this language, it could be even to say, as of this date, it was 0.8%. Mm-hmm. And then the other would say, as of a different date, it was 0.7%.
Mm-hmm. What happened here, the board agenda was drafted at different date. At
uh-huh.
that date, it was something, and the other date,
right.
it was something else. Okay. But eventually, they both get the same rate if they close at the same time.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very
okay.
much.
All right.
The point is well taken, though, that we'll make sure that the description is not
yeah.
confusing.
Okay.
So. Thank you. Thank you.
Okay.
Any other questions? Item 15.
Item 15 is the public school construction program. This is a school in Washington County. Mr. Gorell is here. And the Washington County Commissioners want to sell the former school building site at Kankakee. Tell us what you think.
Thank you, sir, for being here. I don't have any particular objections to the sale, but I was wondering if we had a representative from the Washington County school system here.
Mr. Grell, do you have
oh, I do not know.
Okay, so let me, I'm not going to ask you, Mr. Grell, but I am going to comment on an article I saw last week in the paper out in Washington County. And I'll hold off on specific questions until the October 18th meeting, but I did want to express my concerns about this article published in the Herald Mail, which reported that the Washington County public school system is considering a proposal to contract with a collection agency to go after parents whose children have negative balances on their school meal accounts. Being humiliated and harassed by collectors are the last thing that families who are experiencing financial hardship need. And I sincerely hope that children are not being denied meals or going hungry in school simply because their parents are not or are unable to settle up school meal debts. And as you know, not that I remember everything from my school days, but I would think a letter, sealed letter from the principal back to the parents saying, by the way, I'm sure you've overlooked this, most of that will be settled up. And the ones that are not responsive probably can't be responsive. And the idea of a collection company, and I use these people obviously in my agency's responsibilities, but they're not a particularly empathetic group. And I hope we can get some answers when the Washington County school officials appear before the board at our next meeting. I'm not asking you.
I will relay that to them, though.
But if you could tell them to explain what exactly is going on.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Governor.
Thank you, members.
Thank you.
Could I just correct a misstatement, Governor? We have actually six emergencies on the Secretary's agenda this morning. We had added two hand-carried emergency reports yesterday.
Okay. I don't have any other questions.
Do we have an ongoing mold? I mean, do we wait for people to complain about mold? There are all these mold-related things.
The mold-related problems come about in the buildings many times when the humidity levels in the building go off. And when you have a summer, we have variances like we've had this past year. High temperatures and then, wet seasons. It becomes very hard to control, and especially if people open the windows in a building because it's either too hot or too cold in an area, it throws the balance of the system off. And it creates an environment where mold can increase. And especially
mold.
Yeah.
My question was, do we have an ongoing... How do we know about problems?
We generally, until it's reported, you generally don't know about it because many times it's behind ceiling tiles or behind a wall. And until it becomes a known entity, then we can address it.
No, you could address it earlier. You could. I mean, people do have inspection programs.
We can do inspections, but it would be a pretty significant exercise given the number of buildings that, get reported to us and that we'd have to cover on a statewide basis.
Right. Well, I probably shouldn't go there, but... And just to say that there are different ways of responding. One is waiting for people to get upset enough to call, and the other is to try to do something in a proactive way, and I guess because of cost.
Well, some buildings, at least I know from my days at DGS, we knew were particularly problematic buildings, and so we would go to those buildings and try to make, repairs and adjustments if we could. I think Skilton Street, was...
Hilton Street was one
terrible building, and some of that was due to the roof. There was leaks in the building, and so there were some issues there.
Well, and it's very hard to get rid of it.
Yeah,
it is.
It is, as he said, there's a resource issue in terms of being able to check every building for everything. But when you know that you have water or you know that you have some kind of problem, you can go and check for that as well.
And when we identify a building that is an issue, we do kind of keep a tighter eye on it.
Right, too. Like the Hilton Street.
Like Hilton Street, and we have a
couple of buildings. Which everyone would love to get rid of, but no one has an answer for where the people would go that are there. It's a parole and probation place. The community doesn't like it, but no one, there's no place else to put it.
I'm just curious. There were
We have a motion to. I can second that.
Yeah.
Unless you had more questions.
No.
Okay. I'll say we're all in favor. Okay. Thank you. Department of Natural Resources.
Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. For the record, I'm Mark Belton, the Secretary of the Maryland State Department of Natural Resources, and we have 13 items on our real property agenda for your approval this morning.
I want to ask about number 1A. Looks very familiar to me.
I believe you were the chair of the BPW meeting last time this was brought up and deferred.
Were both of the items, or was it just the second, the Annapolis nature area?
It was just the second one.
Just the second. So now it's
we do have representatives of the city here who can answer any questions if you'd like.
No. Good to see you, Mr. Mayor. I'm not going to ask any questions. I know what it's all about. I still don't like it, but I'm not going to stand in the way of it going forward. So. Just wanted to say that. Oh, I see Bruce Ferriano there with the state socks on.
Yeah.
Should we stand and salute?
I wonder if we could just hear briefly from the county executive and mayor since they're here.
Tag team.
Good morning, Governor Rutherford and Treasurer Kopp and Comptroller Franco. Nice to see all of you. And Mr. Franco, thank you very much for your kind comments about Tina Frost. And would ask everyone to keep her in their prayers. Thank you for allowing the mayor and me to appear today. We appreciate the opportunity. The citizens of Anne Arundel County understand and appreciate the beauty of Quiet Waters Park here in Annapolis, and the city's project next to the county's park will add to that experience and add much-needed preserved land to the Annapolis Neck. Residents here will be able to enjoy a natural recreation area with environmentally sensitive trails linked to Quiet Waters Trail Network, a fitness trail with exercise stations and environmental education stations and other outdoor amenities. Our administration is committed to improving the quality of life for citizens in Anne Arundel County by improving our recreational infrastructure. This new park and recreation area will do just that, and is a demonstration of the great partnership between the city and the county to enhance our citizens' living experience. We ask that the state set aside the needed funds to ensure this park improvement can become a reality. Thank you very much.
Good morning. It's an honor to be here with all of you and everyone in the audience. Just a quick overview on the project. This was something that the city initiated. There was a massive development that was happening, and the citizens were very concerned about the traffic, the detriment to the environment. The city initiated the negotiations and asked if we could purchase the land from them to help with stormwater management, as the county executive alluded to, continuing that park forward. So we're going to purchase 22 acres of land that are priority forest areas right next to Quiet Water Park. And so we think it's a win-win for the community, keeping that green space open. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and I just appreciate both of those statements. And Lieutenant Governor, I shared some of your concerns when I first looked at this. I think I supported you in putting it off, but I was also confused as to why the identity of the developers was so hard for my office to come up with. But apparently yesterday it is Mr. Myers and Mr. Mack and Mr. Fiddler. No problems with developers at all. I just was concerned that nobody would be able to mention their names, and it sounds like a good project that's supported by the city and the county, and obviously these are high quality developers, so happy to be supported.
Okay.
And I give their names just because I publicly asked for them and couldn't get them, and now all of a sudden they're here, which is great. I'm happy that there's a little, you know, not that there was not transparency, but that's the only reason I mentioned their names.
Just took a while. They had to wipe the screen, you know, clear it so you could see through it. Okay. 13A, are there any other questions?
No.
Okay. 13A is the Rural Legacy Program and grants. I believe there are a number of people here with regard to this program, and grants totaling $23.3 million being awarded in multiple counties throughout the state.
If I might, Lieutenant Governor Rutherford,
yes, I'm sorry.
Just to mention this, several years ago in the first year of Governor Hogan's term, he sponsored legislation, House Bill 462, which significantly increased the amount of funding going to transfer tax land conservation programs. And as a result of that bill, $9 million of this $23 million today, we were able to include in the Rural Legacy Grant. So you can see 9 of 23 being a significant portion. We're really able to deal with a backlog of requests in this program. You pointed out 17 different grants, $23 million. That's really monumental and is a great boon to our land conservation program throughout the state of Maryland.
Are the individuals standing in the back underneath all the governors?
We do. We have our sponsor awardees here today, and we would love a picture with the board if that
okay.
would be
where
an opportunity.
Where should we line up? It's up to you.
Have them walk in line up here.
Yeah.
If you're in this room, come walking up the aisle. Everybody else follow, please.
All right, that's good. You can cut and go a little bit more, probably. You can move over a little more if you want. Let the rest of the people. I can pretty much get in the whole entire wall area. Okay, that's good. Looks good. Maybe you guys can tighten it up just a little bit on that side. Looks good. Okay, that looks good. All right. Everybody ready? Okay, right this way. Take a couple of them. One more time. Great, thank you.
Thank you very much. Good to see you. Hello, how are you? Good to see you. Any other questions on natural resources?
That was neat.
We have a motion.
Move approval.
Second.
All right. All in favor. All right. Department of Budget and Management.
Good morning, Lieutenant Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller, David Brinkley, the Secretary of the Department of Budget and Management. Before I move on, I'd like to point out that just yesterday was identified a young woman from Hagerstown. Kristen Bollinger is 21. She, too, was severely injured. In fact, her family didn't know she was injured until yesterday. And her mother works with Frederick County Commissioner. I guess now we have a council, Frederick County Councilman Tony Schmelly. And so for his firm. And so our thoughts and prayers are also with them. And in fact, the young man that worked with her was, in fact, killed. More information, I guess, to come. Our department has submitted 15 items for your agenda. Items 15S through 15S mod are hand carried. We're prepared to address any questions that you might have.
Okay. Before we get to the retroactives, I have a question on 18S. Human Resources or Human Services.
8S, Greg James, Deputy Secretary. And Roger Lewis, SSA Contracts and Monitoring Manager.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I am Greg James. I'm Deputy Secretary for Operations at the Maryland Department of Human Services.
My question is, this one has to do with two individuals, two young people who are out of state placement. And this goes to what the comptroller mentioned earlier, that it states that one of the young people are going to age out during the option year. What happens once that child ages out?
So when a youth ages out, there is a transition plan for that youth in terms of either reunification with the family or moving to an adult program that's appropriate for them. It varies on a case-by-case basis, but at this point, we actually only have one youth remaining at this program because one of the youth did transition back to Maryland, and we're working with the family there on services for that youth. The youth who's at the program now, we anticipate within the next year that they're going to be able to reunify with their mother, who has actually moved from Maryland to New Jersey. The program's in the Philadelphia area. They moved to New Jersey so they could be close to their child and work on that reunification process and be an active participant in their therapy, which is one reason why we believe, on balance, that maintaining this placement was appropriate for this youth at this time.
I guess it goes to just the question of mental health. Is there an assessment that's done before that child reaches 18? And then there's some, because, and this is a gripe that I've had with how we do it, and it goes to our health care and our HIPAA, is that for 17 years and 364 days, the parent can direct treatment for their child. They can get information with regard to the child, and family member can do that. As soon as they hit 18, that stops. Like, all of a sudden, that person is capable of making their own decisions. Mm-hmm. When a day before they weren't, but they hit this date that they can. And so that was my concern when I saw the age out, that that there's some process that does an evaluation of this child before they hit that date, so that there's an assessment to say that they still need to have a certain amount of care. They may be a danger to themselves or others, or just not able to care for themselves.
So we actually start transition planning for our youth at 14.
Okay.
By law, that's when we start working on the transition plan. It had been our practice, but we changed the law recently. It has not always been a perfect process. What I will say is, in the past year, we have done a tremendous job of improving our coordination with our sister agencies, Behavioral Health and Developmental Disabilities Administration. So at least for the youth in the developmental disabilities side, what we are now starting to do is proactively work with them and transition the youth before they hit their age-out point, which is they can check themselves out of service at 18, but we actually continue to provide service for foster youth until they're 21. So those youth in our care, we go up to 21. But we work to, if it looks like they're going to be transitioning into a developmental disabilities adult program, we look for an opportunity to have that youth transition well before they turn 21, so that there's a smooth transition instead of what had been occurring previously, which was a youth would hit 21 or be a few weeks before 21, and all of a sudden people started 21 for most of the foster youth would fall under this. Maryland has been at the forefront in terms of extending the length of stay in foster youth for just the issues you recognize, that we realize that kids at 18 aren't able to provide for themselves and necessarily make the best decisions. Legally, they're adults and they can check out of the program if they're competent, but we continue to offer services until they're 21. So with the developmental disabilities folks, we don't want to wait and just have a phone call the week before and say, hey, you're going to need to pick up this kid. And by the way, they'll be cut off from all the supports and the services and everybody that they knew. And be starting over cold with a new program. We want to have that be a six-month or a one-year transition between our two different programs so that the youth can become acclimated. We continue to provide services even as they're getting to know the new team that's going to be working with them at developmental disabilities. We're working on the same types of transitions with behavioral health for youth with mental health issues.
Thank you, Greg.
Yes, I'm glad you brought this item up, and just note for the record that I had an excellent meeting with the interagency work group led by Mr. James and Ms. Page recently, and that group has been working diligently to identify solutions to bring 38 children currently in out-of-state treatment facilities home to Maryland. I was delighted to hear that progress is being made on the issue. I'm a little disheartened that the department has yet to come up with a plan to bring all of these kids home, especially since we've learned about a number of disturbing and horrific incidents of abuse and neglect at some of the out-of-state facilities that house and are entrusted with the care of these young Marylanders. That said, I did want to ask the department if they were aware of the fact that Foundations Behavioral Health in Doylestown, Pennsylvania, one of the three out-of-state providers recommended for a contract award today, was fined by the U.S. Occupational Safety and Health Administration last year for what sounds like a number of very serious violations. According to news reports, this organization, a subsidiary of United Health Services, was fined $37,000 for, quote, failing to protect workers from physical assaults by patients, failing to conduct an annual review of its bloodborne pathogen program, and to provide appropriate training for registered nurses and mental health technicians. Was the department aware that United Health was fined for these violations? And can you tell us how many Maryland residents are currently under the care of this treatment provider?
Thank you, Mr. Comptroller. And thank you for the meeting last week. That was very helpful for us as well. Currently, we have one Maryland youth who is placed at Doylestown. The department was aware of the fine and the issues raised by OSHA. With all of our out-of-state providers, we are in close contact with their licensing entity within the state of Pennsylvania in this case. And we discussed this incident and we discussed these allegations. The program, since that fine and that finding by OSHA, has put in corrective action measures and has addressed the issues so that we believe that it remains an appropriate placement for this youth. We have also increased our monitoring of out-of-state programs, both in terms of the social worker's direct visit with the youth and our contract monitoring, which goes out on a quarterly basis to make unannounced visits to the programs. And at this time, we still have confidence in this program.
Excellent. Thank you for that. Obviously, I just want to reinforce my position that we should bring all of these children home to Maryland so they can receive the care that they deserve, and locally at treatment facilities that can be monitored by Maryland agencies. And I know you have trips that visit these out-of-state facilities, but my view is that out-of-state placements and the dangers they pose to our children are well documented. And obviously, I've brought these concerns up in meetings at this board level. I'm not going to relitigate those concerns, but I want to make sure that the department continues to monitor what's happening at these out-of-state facilities and that the agency remains confident that the Maryland children placed there will be adequately cared for until we can bring them home to Maryland. But thank you, Mr. James.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Secretary, you mentioned that you have a number of retroactive contracts that are on your agenda. They are MTA related.
Yeah. Okay.
Comments from transportation?
Sure.
We have a number of them that are in different agendas.
That's actually what I was going to say. We have some on this agenda, and I think it's 11 of your 15 items, if I'm not mistaken. And then we have some on the MDOT's agenda.
And
general services, you're right. And so we're spread all over the state. Well, no, I'll be glad to answer any questions you might have on any of the agendas.
Well, I understand that corrective actions have been taken. Could you explain those, or if you want to have Mr. Zimmerman?
Absolutely. No, I can address many of those. Okay, so, and we talked about this at the last BPW meeting. Also, when the comptroller had some questions about some other retros that we had brought last time, and you know all too well, Lieutenant Governor, that the governor, Governor Hogan, recognized that procurement was a problem statewide and had been for many, many years. And that's why he appointed you to lead the workforce and the task force for procurement changes. I know that you and your group have made sweeping changes, and I'm going to assure you that Secretary Ron has also done the same thing in our department. But also want to mention, and I know you know this, that much of this has been going on for a lot of years, and we inherited a lot of those problems. We made a lot of changes with regard to policy, procedures, and personnel. Through those changes, we have discovered, and we are continuing to discover, quite frankly, a lot of the inconsistencies, and we're addressing them as we discover them, obviously by bringing them forward to you at the BPW. One of the things that Pete Ron has done in probably the last 4 or 5 weeks is that he's asked Mike Zimmerman, the procurement director for the secretary's office, to take over and manage MTA's procurement operations. He felt that we needed to get a thorough review of the gaps at MTA and make sure that we are assessing all the potential needs at the MTA, which might include training, taking a look at the timeline, stopping the inconsistencies, and quite frankly, how to get MTA back on track. And based on early assessments, we began, I think, what's going to be a model for the state, a procurement academy. The procurement academy was begun to help the shortfalls that we have in the procurement field, sort of like the same shortfalls in IT and engineering. We believe by giving state employees, current state employees, the opportunity to train in the procurement field, it's going to end up being a win-win for us because, one, it'll help the gaps, the shortages in procurement, and it also gives employees the opportunity to create a new career path for themselves. And so, again, we look at that as a win-win. The next step in the what we would still dub the Procurement Academy is to try and make sure that all of our procurement agents have the same level of training, because we're going to create a training program for everyone. That training program would, one, bring them up to the same level, and then, two, continue to train people as we move forward on any changes in laws or regulations that we would have through legislation or regulatory changes. We also recently purchased some software that will track these items more effectively. We expect that moving forward, we're going to get a better grasp on procuring items on time and paying our vendors on time, which is what the comptroller brought up last time. We're developing an RFP right now for RFID, which is radio frequency identification. The first step of that RFP is going to be for inventory control under the control agency of DGS. You know, we have that. We have to control our inventory. So the first part is going to be inventory control because we've had some challenges in that area. The second part is going to be expanding that to our parts inventory control. And so we believe
we're doing this across all the modes.
We're doing it across all the TBUs, what we call transportation business units now. We're doing it all across the TBUs. This is a M.wide effort.
And do all the TBUs realize that they work for MDOT?
Oh, yeah, they do now.
There had been a history, for those who are unaware, that the units used to think that they were independent entities. And so that's...
Until Pete Ron came along. And as you know, we've had the accelerator, which Pete Ron started.
Let me interrupt you.
Sure.
I want to mention that Bob Gleason, who's here. Bob, can you stand up just for a moment? Bob was hired as the senior procurement executive, and I know he's had conversations with Mike Zimmerman, and one of his tasks, his early tasks, he just is a month and 3 days, I think, on the job, is to look at our training and lack thereof. And I asked him to talk to Mike Zimmerman because we know that you have a training program. Mm-hmm. And a lot of this is lack of training, management, contract management issues. As you mentioned, a number of these contracts may have been originally led in 2013 and some of the commodities were earlier, but the contracts expired and people were continuing to use these contracts. And so that's a major, and in some cases didn't have a contract, but just were calling up someone. I know also the MDOT or the Department of Transportation's auditors have taken a look at this, and so I'm glad that that the Secretary has asked the auditors to take a closer look at what's going on, along with taking responsibility for oversight, bringing it into the Secretary's office. I know Mike Zimmerman. He was on our commission, or at least was the designee on the commission. And so appreciative of that. But it is very troubling in terms of what's going on. When I look at 11, starting with that one, the previous contract expired in 14. Inappropriate change orders were used to continue to fund this contract and extend the contract without supporting documentation. A new contract was in late 2014. Others that are somewhat similar, you know, we need to find out why that happened, how that happened. A couple of these vendors, they were denied SDOT issues. The contractor is trying to get compliance with SDOT. I guess that means they're not paying their taxes or something. So there's some real trouble. And I even have a question for budget and management on this, because some of their, what I would call boilerplate language, and I'll start with 12, 12 has it, that it says the retroactive approval is requested under the appropriate section of the finance and procurement article. DBM has determined this contract should be treated as voidable rather than void because all the parties have acted in good faith. Well, you don't know that. So please, none of the other agencies use this kind of language. And I know it's boilerplate, but that's a problem with boilerplate. You don't know if it was done in good faith. I would hope it was done in good faith. There's a second one that may be okay, but then it says number third, the violation or series of violations was insignificant or otherwise did not prevent substantial compliance with the procurement law. It did. It was in, out of compliance with procurement law. Don't use this language if you don't know the facts. If you're not doing the due diligence, don't use this kind of language. And so I ask you, Mr. Secretary, to talk to your folks about putting this in the public record when we don't know the details.
They've already heard that, sir.
Okay. Number 13 is a retroactive contract. Wells Fargo Insurance Services, you know, it's like, I guess what I said, what happened and how did this happen that they're using these professional services for some period of time and no one knew that this contract had expired? We don't need to go through each and every one of them, but there's a problem. 14 is another one where SDOT denied because the contractor's probably not paying. 15 is probably even more egregious in terms of when I go back to this boilerplate language, which I find particularly troublesome. Because MTA failed to execute a second renewal option for this contract. Instead, they continued to extend the contract with the contractor through change orders. That is a complete violation, and it's significant. It's not insignificant.
We agree.
So...
And Lieutenant,
I'm sorry for venting, but I think that it's really problematic, and it goes across agencies.
I appreciate that, Lieutenant Governor. And you'll notice, again, on just because you mentioned this one last, this goes back to 2012, okay?
Right, but I mean, even though it went to 2012, it wasn't corrected when opportunities came up. It's sloppiness, and I'm not...
We agree.
This stuff is in the bowels of the organization.
Correct.
And it takes time, I know, from leadership. I can fuss at you, I can fuss at the secretary here, mm-hmm. but it means that you got to tell your people to burrow down into the bowels, the basement of the organization, and let them know that, and I truthfully don't think it's corruption. I think it's sloppiness, I think it's lack of education, and not looking out for the taxpayers' dollars. I think that's...
Okay. I would agree with everything except for the last point you made, not looking out for taxpayers' dollars, because what we are doing is the right thing now. As you mentioned...
Now, I'm talking about what happened.
Right.
I'm not talking about right now. I'm talking about what happened. The people who are doing these things don't understand that they're working with taxpayers' dollars. They're working with your family's dollars. They're working with everyone in this room's dollars except for those who don't pay taxes. You know? That's what I'm talking about. And we have to get that message through to people who are at different levels. They're not sitting in the secretary's office. They're not sitting on the second floor. But they're working day to day. And it gets to the point where it becomes mechanical. And we have to tell them it's not mechanical.
It is not. And that's why the secretary, Secretary Ron, took the drastic step to have Mike Zimmerman, the director of TSO, the secretary's office, TSO, oversee and manage the MTA because of the very thing that you said. People were not getting the message. We tried to drill down. We tried to send the message. And they weren't getting it. So now we are taking it over. We're literally taking it over because we think by doing so, they are absolutely going to get the message. And I can tell you that we are putting other things in place for inventory control. We are going to create a new position because, and I'm going to say this about MTA, we're creating a new position at MTA for inventory control that is not going to report to operations. It is going to report directly to procurement director Mike Zimmerman.
Right.
Okay? And so not only are we doing that by creating this system, but we're going to look at the lead times from the manufacturer. We're going to look at the supply time. We're going to look at the handling time and the time it takes to ship these products. We are also going to look to see if the manufacturers or suppliers, in this case, can inventory some of the stock on their shelves instead of ours, so we wouldn't have so much stock on our shelves, so we wouldn't have to obsolete it later. We're looking at the as I mentioned, the RFID. Once we get those parts inventoried and RFID on there, every time somebody takes a part out of inventory, it comes off. We're going to look at the lead time it takes for the manufacturer to produce it and get it to us. We're going to look at the burn rate, if you will. That's what they call it when you're using the product. We're going to look at how often we use them, weekly, monthly, annually. And through that data, we're going to combine that information to find out exactly how much inventory so we can keep the least amount on the shelves that we can and only order appropriately. The other thing that this position is going to do is it is going to be the arbiter for any new product that's ordered. Any new product to order has to be justified by this person that reports to Mike Zimmerman. The other thing they're going to do is, on the other end, when it comes in from the supplier, they are going to be in charge of counting that inventory, making sure we got what we paid for, and then they're going to be in charge of the analysis for the lead times from the supplier and et cetera. Now, I did this at BG&E. Mm-hmm. I was in procurement. I was a material specialist. I understand this process. That's why I got directly involved in this, okay? I was very successful at BG&E, Baltimore Gas Electric, in saving hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars. So what we are doing literally today is bringing private sector ideas and successes into the public sector. We are not sitting back.
We are not sitting back, but
we are getting involved.
Mr. Ports,
yes,
I know you're not sitting back, but just-in-time inventory has been around for years and years that you were at BG&E. But, yeah, so it does require, I mean, this is why it's very important that not only when we put people at the top, that we put people in other places who are coming in to think differently,
mm-hmm.
that are coming in. Because probably that, those guys and gals are sitting there in the inventory section, which, as I understand, they used to have them separated, and procurement was much more involved in inventory at MDOT before someone made a decision to move it all into the operations unit, which provided no checks and balances and possibly led to some of this stuff here. But... you know, that's something that someone should have been thinking about years ago. And I hate to go to that. I shouldn't even be talking about what it should have been, because what you're saying, just-in-time inventory has been around for years.
Correct.
You know, even the federal government moved away from big supply houses mm-hmm. and big, you know, depots. They moved away from that. You know, there's some you have for emergency purposes. But, okay, I've had enough of beating this dead horse. I hope it's dead. If not, I'm going to kill it.
It's on its way out. It's going to the glue factory.
So, as the resident expert at beating dead horses, let me. I want to associate myself with the remarks of the Lieutenant Governor, and obviously for years I have talked about the fact that retroactive contracts are not the way for the state of Maryland to do business. And frankly, I think the administration's response to this issue is a breath of fresh air, and I'm frankly delighted to hear the Lieutenant Governor, happy to hear from the Deputy Secretary that improvements are being put in place, because here's the theme. We're saving taxpayers' money.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a skepticism out there in the public that we are handling their money carefully. And so this is much appreciated. I guess I wanted to ask the Secretary, DBM Secretary, Secretary Brinkley, I understand that the administration is sending a message to all the departments and agencies in transportation. Does that include all the agencies
yes.
in state government?
We're doing that in all of our agencies. In fact, we had a staff person, Rachel, last year that I mentioned earlier, who took the initiative to create a very good spreadsheet, not just to identify what was deficient, but then also what was upcoming. Something very simple tech. And so you saw some of those items brought before this board for correction, updating, and everything else. And now, you know, obviously, the transportation division is now bringing all those to your attention, too.
Good. I want to acknowledge that and acknowledge the administration's efforts in this point. And just to put on the record, some of the savings, the five retroactive contracts at our September 20th meeting, one of which was a vendor who had not been paid for months, as the Lieutenant Governor mentioned, the total dollar value of those retroactive contracts was $318,022. And so now we're going to sign off on these 33 retroactive contracts. And I agree with the Lieutenant Governor that they are... well, let's put it bluntly, they're just violations of our procurement laws.
Mm-hmm.
So, Lieutenant Governor, I think your passion and your energy on this issue is absolutely appropriate. So, what are we talking about in the total of 31 we're being asked to approve today? We're talking about $3.3 million being spent over and above what this board authorized on 13 separate contracts. We're talking about $6.9 million being spent on 11 contracts that expired, but the vendor continued performing the services that MDOT requested. And perhaps the most egregious of all, we're talking about $4.8 million being paid to seven vendors when there were no contracts in place. So I suspend judgment, as the Lieutenant Governor does, as to whether it's a lack of oversight or confusion, mismanagement, miscommunication, or something else going on. But I think Deputy Secretary Ports, you get the message from us that I guess my question is this. Are we going to see more of these? Or is this a scrubbing of what you have? And
so I think I would answer that question like this.
Are we going to see more in the future?
I think you will. I think as we continue to dig into the procurement issues at MTA, and if you will, use the analogy, turning over rocks, we are going to find a poly you know what, and we're going to continue to find that, and we are going to continue to bring them forward, because our role and our goal, and Pete Ron's been very clear about this, is to dig deep and find all this stuff, bring it to your attention so that we can get it right, so we have the authorization to spend these monies appropriately. And, again, as Lieutenant Governor said, send the signal to the rest of the organization. We're not fooling around anymore. So no. We will. I guarantee we will have some more come forward. There's no question in my mind.
Thank you for your candor, because I agree that that's what you're going to end up with. But I'm...
that's not my goal, by the way.
I understand.
I want to be clear. It's not my goal.
Well, what we're talking about is a drastic departure from the way business was conducted in the past.
Correct.
And it's going to, as the Lieutenant Governor said, take time to actually trickle down and fix the broken culture of state procurement. Mm-hmm. So have at it. And Mr. Secretary, Secretary Brinkley, if you could keep us informed as to the response of other agencies, I agree that this is a significant improvement and can save the taxpayers a considerable amount of money. So,
Mr. Comptroller, I'll add to echo part of what we're doing here is as these are discovered, they then come to light. And this is the forum for them to come
correct
to light, for those conversations
correct
to take place.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly why you're seeing this brought before you.
No, it's got to, and once it changes for good.
Correct.
You know, it's not like a temporary mindset or something. It's, I agree with Lieutenant Governor, once you implement something that is programmatic like this, yeah, so I wouldn't be I'm not that you're being defensive, but
no.
I would not be defensive about bringing this stuff forward in the future, because it shows you're getting to the bottom
right
of it.
And I guarantee I'll continue to be responsible as long as Governor Hogan's in office and he allows me to have this position.
Well, I think...
Could I just ask one question?
Yeah,
I mean,
go ahead.
This is not the first time we've seen this, and it won't be the last time we've seen it. It's interesting, it's MTA, because we went through SHA a few years ago, and we have not seen so much recently mm-hmm from SHA, so something changed there. But I guess my question is to you, David. One of the problems throughout the agency seemed to have been the separation between procurement and contracts and operations and ongoing oversight of contracts. That they're procured, everything's put in place, and often things in social services, for instance, are outsourced, and we're supposed to be monitoring everything and then know when they come back. So you're going to get something in place, I guess, that'll spit up the date for when the contract expires, and then the contract people will look at them again. But it seems to me, unless something is done about the disconnect between procurement and contract oversight,
exactly right,
these things are going to keep happening. And I don't know if
well,
Mr. Zimmerman is in charge of everything going on, but I can't believe that one person can do that at all.
Yeah.
So the question is, institutional?
Well, you do have to have separation from the person who's buying the procurement and the user
absolutely
of it, because the user falls in love with their product. The procurement person is supposed to be dispassionate and
but the
not
procurement
have any
person
personal
traditionally has gone on from procurement to procurement to procurement.
Right, but it is the management management part that procurement officer needs to be able to track when these contracts are coming up, and inform their customer, which is the user, that this contract is coming up and we're getting ready to go to a new bid process or whatever. And they're going to be, you know, unfortunately, there may be times where it slips, and but at least you come in and say, we need to extend this contract while we do rebid this contract. So systems will address, and that's what Secretary Brinkley had talked about, what they're doing. Systems help to address. I know that Mike Zimmerman has talked about systems at MDOT, and, of course, with Mr. Gleason coming on board, he's going to help in that whole process so that we can have a better global picture of what we're buying and selling. I want to just state with regard to the retroactives that, you know, as Secretary Quartz just mentioned, you know, I think when these items were pulled off of the agenda before and then brought back so that we could do all through some in further investigation, there were four additional retroactives that were added. So, you know, as they delve into challenges that are taking place at MTA and maybe other places, we're going to see this. But that's the cleaning process. Mm-hmm. You know, they're cleaning it up. And I appreciate the fact that Secretary Ron has taken the step of moving the oversight out of MTA and looking at the training process and lack thereof for the people there. I appreciate the fact that he's brought the auditor in to take a closer look, and appreciate the fact that he's notified also the legislative auditors to let them know that we're taking a closer look at this whole thing. So
does he just send you when there's bad news on the school calendar?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's, that's what number two is all about. There's nothing that ever changes with that.
And the governor sends me when he wants to.
Actually, Secretary Ron, it was his birthday the other day, so he was back home in New Mexico celebrating his birthday, so that's why he's out here. He's on his way back.
It wasn't our birthday.
It was his birthday. It was his birthday. He was celebrating with his family.
He's had a couple of those before.
A few.
All right, any other questions on the BBM's agenda?
3S.
3S.
3S. About MSDE, Christy. Mike, is it Michael or Michelle? I always mess it up. Michael. Thank you.
There's room at the front to sit for those who are standing in the back. Is this an elementary school or church?
We're ready to start out the door.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Christy Michael. I'm the Deputy Superintendent for Finance and Administration at MSDE. We're here today to ask approval of a credit for a contract we have for our high school assessments. The contract is closing out in a few months, and we were able to realize some cost savings as we close the contract out.
Excellent. I always find it refreshing when we see contract modification requests that return money to the taxpayer. So thank you for that oversight and supervision. I do have a couple of questions. According to the background materials provided by you, the vendor reprinted testing forms from the 2016 testing schedule and used them for the 2017 testing schedule. Does that make sense to you, or is that why we're getting $65,000 back?
Yes, that's how we're realizing the savings. We did reuse some test forms that had been used in previous test administrations, and I specifically did ask this question, that there is a very low probability that a student would have seen the same form or test outline had they previously taken the test. There are a number of different forms we use and different methodologies for putting them together.
So I guess I'm a little confused as to why we're only getting $65,000 back if they're using last year's questions.
I'm going to bring up Dr. Doug Strader. He's our director of the assessments program.
This is a $8.4 million one-year extension to a contract, so they obviously get a lot of money in there. If they use last year's questions, why are we only getting a small percentage back?
So we need to maintain the quality and integrity of the program. So we do an analysis of exposure of our items and forms. What you're talking about here, the overall contract value includes the scoring and reporting. The scoring itself is the bulk of the contract cost. We were able to, on some of our forms, be able to reuse some items in the past instead of having to engage in new development. for those particular pieces. So going through that, that's where we're able to recognize the savings.
I'm sorry, some of that went, just thinking of something else for a minute, I guess. How did you come up with the $65,000 figure?
When you look at the development cost of the actual items that were reused, that's where you would come up with that savings figure. We went back and forth with the vendor to negotiate that upon finding this potential from our previous items for the reuse. So you're not reusing the entire test from both these times, but you still have...
How much of the previous test was used?
So looking at the forms, we have a bio... Excuse
me? Why don't you come up and identify yourself?
Brianna Creed is in charge of the high school assessment program. She's in the detail of that work. But you can speak to the actual items themselves.
But I'm sorry, I didn't hear your response.
Why don't you come up and introduce yourself on the record, please?
Good morning. I'm Brianna Creed. I'm the program manager for the HSAs, which is the high school assessment. So for the ETS contract, we had a reuse of forms that would include three for the biology and three for the government. So you would have six total reuse of forms in addition to an accommodative form, which would put it to eight. So in terms of your cost savings, however, you're looking at just those actual forms that are developed. But in terms of the entire administration scoring and reporting, since that's the bulk of the cost, you'll find the cost savings is only in the reuse of the items themselves.
Okay. And you're saying that ETS does the scoring? Isn't that done by a separate vendor?
Subcontractor under ETS. It is a subcontractor under ETS, Pearson.
So do they have a separate contract or they're paid by ETS?
ETS is the prime. Pearson is a subcontractor under ETS.
So they're paying them out of the $8,395,000.
That would be correct, yes.
Okay. You mentioned Pearson because there's an article today in the paper, I think, in the Sun, about the fact that 12% of Baltimore City kids pass these PARC tests. Is this what Pearson's involved in? You guys, who does the PARC test?
The test. PARC test itself?
Yeah.
So there's many components to the assessment. So you were mentioning the high school assessments as well. Pearson manages the scoring of the selected response items. The extending construction response items are done by a company called Measurement Incorporated, which is a completely different sub. So when you're talking about the development of the PARC assessments, that's now being turned over to a company by the name of New Meridian. So it depends on what aspect of the assessment program that you're referring to. Pearson does not own the PARC assessments. That's owned through a collaborative. CCSSO actually owns the IP associated with the assessments. So
okay, so maybe you could get back in response to this article that's out there that says 15% of Baltimore City students passed the English part of the test and 12% passed the math test PARC assessment, and that the system was stunned because some of their best students were in the 88% of math testers who failed. And they went back and looked at it and somehow got it increased a little bit, but basically it was the kids were getting the right answers, but they couldn't explain the reasoning. That's what the article said. I mean, this is just adds more lunacy to this program of over-testing that we have. If, in fact, the kids are getting the right answers on the test, but they're not meeting some, how did you get that answer? I got the answer because I'm smart, I understand math, I understand English, I have the right answer, but yeah, this is just incomprehensible, hundreds of millions of dollars added to the taxpayers. It produces these ridiculous numbers that 88% of the kids are flunking math tests and 85% of flunking English tests. The impression is the kids are not smart. The kids are smart. Apparently, they're getting the answers right, but they're not following the intricacies of whoever the heck is preparing these tests. And I hope maybe you could just read the article and send me the explanation as to why this is beneficial to the kids, the faculty, the those of us that live in the state, that we have to read about this kind of humiliation. And, hey, I wasn't an A-plus student, but I was a pretty good student. I could never figure out how I got to the right answer. I mean, really. But think back to your school days.
So that's why you went to law school.
Yeah. Yeah. That was a big mistake. You get the drift. I just if you could send me a little primer on what we're spending on these tests now and what these tests are showing and when these contracts are coming back up again, because I hope that we can significantly prune them back so that you guys can spend your time on something more productive and useful than making people feel bad about themselves. I feel bad for the kids.
We would be happy to provide a summary of all our assessment program and the various assessments that are administered in the local school system.
Great. Just bring me up to date on where we are in these massive contracts. I remember hundreds of millions of dollars flowing out of here to Pearson and their peers, and I guess I'm not sure what the Park Consortium is, but if you could just give me a heads up, and the other members of the board are interested, give them a heads up as to when these contracts are going to be coming before us again.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
All right. Sorry, I wasn't trying to give you a hard time. I went to law school, too. So.
Can I just say, it really is important to know why you came up with a specific answer to these questions so that you can do it again, as opposed to just happily alighting on the right numbers or understanding of foreign text or whatever. But I don't want to.
So it was a very interesting, speaking of newspapers, an interesting article in the Washington Post a number of months ago, and it was basically a book review about a woman who, American-born, but she and her husband live in China, and it was about her sending her child to Chinese school. And, you know, it kind of reminds you of how it used to be in the olden days. I mean, her basic point was that the teacher is always right, that she went there to fuss at the teacher about what the teacher did, which was a little beyond what teachers did in the old days. But the teacher pulled her to the side and said, in front of the kids, I am always right. And she said she had to adjust to that.
It's what I say to the comptroller's agency. The comptroller's always right. But yes, I understand that. I understand what the treasurer mentioned. I would love to have everybody very fluent in all of the analysis of how you got from A to B. But let's be honest. I mean, this is not good to stigmatize areas of the state with these bad results and put our kids through this kind of you got the right answer, but we're not sure you actually can explain how you got there. I mean, give me a break. Let's get back to just teaching, get these kids out of school much more as competent as we can. But the idea that I just remember the smart kids, the really smart kids, the Treasurer Cox and the Boyd Rutherford in my class, they knew all of this stuff. But most of us, it was just, you know, it was just mind-boggling. How do you follow the rabbit down the rabbit hole and come up, speaking of what the teacher said, how do you mimic what the teacher apparently thinks is the way that I'm getting to this answer? And how do I diagram that out somehow? I'm speaking for a vast majority of kids. If they can read, if they can do the math, let's test that. Let's make sure they can do it. Let's stop the psychoanalysis of, I remember in English, the sentence diagrams. Remember that? Where we had to underline everything and put it all out? I mean, after a while, you're just like, gosh, I'm getting it all right, but I can't get the diagram right. Really? It's just a cry from
my controller. My teacher, right, was only with regard to discipline and things like that.
Yeah.
Less than we talk about that. It was discipline. Okay. Any other questions on budget and management?
Move approval.
We're all in favor. Thank you. University system. Good morning.
Good morning. Joe Evans represented University System of Maryland. We have five items on the agenda. We are withdrawing item 4RP. You can ask any questions.
I just want to indicate on item 4, I've been contacted by Senator Rosapath and Delegate Jocelyn Pena Melnick, and I understand that that's being withdrawn so that you can talk to College Park about meeting their concerns about having a seat at the table for the Terrapin Development Corporation. My concern is I sympathize with them. I support them in that. I applaud your effort to get together with them. And I understand they sat with the treasurer also. So that's good. My concern is different. My concern is once we hand over these properties to the Terrapin Development Corporation, traditionally the Board of Public Works reviews what if there's a change in the lease or the ownership of the property. The board looks at that and approves it. Rarely does it turn it down, but we approve it. That is being that's been eliminated, and if it's not there when you bring this back, it's going to be a problem for me as the comptroller, because the explanation that I got from the university as to why they wanted to cut out the Board of Public Works didn't make any sense at all. It was essentially, we're doing deals with private developers and they don't want to have the Board of Public Works. If I were a private developer, having gone through the blizzard of things that they have to go through to get an approval for a project, I'd be delighted to come before this board and get the approval of the governor and the treasurer and the comptroller. So there's a two-pronged problem here to this, and I just don't want you to come back up 2 weeks from now or whenever you're coming back up with a big resolution of the College Park problem thinking that it's smooth sailing.
I'll convey that back.
Please. Yeah. It's important.
Well, I thought the city was in concurrence with the whole project. They had a letter of support. So,
Maybe I'm completely wrong. Why are you pulling it?
The reason I was given was that they had they wanted to address some further concerns from the treasurer's office. Is what I was.
No, they were not.
That's not.
That was not it. They said that they wish to have further discussions with the representatives of the 21st Legislative District.
Oh, it's the legislators who've been calling.
Who has not been notified, nor and who represent, obviously, the people who live there, just as do the city councilmen and women.
Oh, I'm sorry. Stakeholders at College Park.
Yes, it was not the treasurer.
It was not what?
It wasn't the treasurer.
The reason was the further discussion with the stakeholders in College Park.
I'm sorry. Yeah,
but that is an issue that is the community concern, and yes. I sympathize with the community.
Yeah.
And as a former elected official, their representatives. But this is a bigger issue, which is why exactly is the board being cut out of this, where we traditionally, with other members of the system and frankly lots of other contracts, we have that oversight responsibility. Once again, just following up on making sure the taxpayers are protected.
Yes, sir.
Any other questions on universities? Item? We have a motion for the
move approval.
Okay. Thank you very much. Department of Information Technologies.
Good morning, Lieutenant Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. For the record, my name is Albert Bullock. I'm the Assistant Secretary for Administration with the Department of Information Technology. We have three hand-carried items on the agenda today, and we have agency representative to address.
Round two.
I think you probably addressed all the questions we have on this. The second one is looks like a contract creep where it was a services or a hardware contract and they bought services. So that's a...
Yeah. I couldn't believe that.
I think you talked about the corrective actions. And, second?
Okay. Second.
All right. That one was easy. Department of Transportation. I haven't heard from you.
Good morning, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller, and Governor. For the record, my name is Jim Forrest. I'm Deputy Secretary for Maryland Department of Transportation. Maryland Department of Transportation has 40 items for your consideration today. Items 22 through 40 were submitted as hand-carried items. And at this time, MDOT is withdrawing 4M, 12RP, and 15RP. I'm more than happy to answer any questions you may have in continuing round three of the beating of the dead horse, if you so choose.
We're going to bring it back to life. And then be
okay.
This isn't a question on eight. It's a condolences on, or not a condolences, but appreciation. The Small Business Reserve, State Highway Maintenance Contract, we put it in the Small Business Reserve Program. I'm going to be sending a letter out to all of the departments and agencies reinforcing that effective first of this month, the Small Business Reserve Program has been increased to 15%, and more state agencies are required to comply with this and making sure that the top dogs let the other folks know that they have to start putting these contracts into the Small Business Reserve Program. So, and it's not just small dollars. Smaller contractors can do $1 million and above contracts, and so ask the procurement professionals to do their due diligence and make sure that they do that.
Can I just ask about that one, the withdrawn one? When it comes back, I mean, I assume you will celebrate the winter holidays, number four, at the airport. Will it still be $1 million?
We withdrew that contract.
I mean, we want people to have a very positive experience.
Yeah.
Truly.
Can you pull out the old stuff in the closet or in the attic?
We pulled that one, so I was hoping not to have to answer any questions on it. But we pulled it because we're going to have more thorough discussions about other opportunities to make this happen.
It's a 5-year contract. It wasn't $1 million for one Christmas.
Thank you.
Okay, so it's probably a lot of labor.
Well, and you got to get up on the big buckets and all that kind of stuff. I mean, it's the ceilings are extremely high.
And so you get trees from DNR.
We don't cut down trees. We plant them.
Yes, we do.
Yeah, only for a certain line of the color of San Montgomery County, but I'm not going
to. You're not going to say
that. I'm not going to say that. Okay. I've already. This is a retroactive. So, 34, it's just a question. I wasn't sure if the contractor was paid. The contractors, this is the paving and parking area. It wasn't clear whether they have been paid under the work that they did, the additional work.
Yes, they have been paid.
Okay. All right. This is just 36. We're extending the contract for 19 months. Does it take it that long to do a new procurement, 19 months?
Go ahead, Joe.
This is a maintenance contract.
Good morning, y'all.
Good morning.
This time,
identify yourself.
Oh, my name is Joe Sedetal. I'm the Deputy Director of Procurement at the MTA. This contract, we're not actually extending it 19 months. This contract is still valid. We blew through the authority line by around $110,000. So with the remainder of the contract still going, we're adding $450,000 to perform the service until the contract expires.
Okay. All right.
So that's what not managing the burn rate means.
Exactly.
Yes.
Correct.
All right. Thank you. Thanks, Victor. I don't have any other. Second. We're all in favor. General Services, you come back for that.
Thank you. Oh, yeah, that's right. I'm not done yet.
Good morning, Lieutenant Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. For the record, I'm Nelson Reichert, Deputy Secretary of General Services. The department has 9 items on our agenda. 3 are hand-carried, and there was a protest on item 2AE, but there is no one here to speak on their behalf.
We did get a memorandum from Sheila McDonald with regard to that. Okay, and so...
So the protest has been noted for the record, and
right.
it is in the record on the file, and it was distributed to the board members. But the person, the entity that protested, told us they were not going to present in front of the board.
Actually,
I do think that they actually said they would abide by the board.
Oh.
On the first.
Very nice.
We'll see. But that's
nice.
What was about telephone conversation.
Real quick, number 9, Mr. Forge. This was, again, one of those, one troubling that the DGS had a contract for the purchase of petroleum products.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a new contract and a new vendor, but MTA decided to use the old vendor, even though the contract had expired. There's a new vendor, new contract. Did they just not know, or did they just say, I like Jim as the salesperson, I'm going to keep buying?
I hope it's not number 2. Okay.
All right.
Poor oversight.
That sounds really, I hope it's where they just didn't know. But, and that's not an excuse, but it's not corruption.
No.
Okay. I don't have any other questions. Okay. Well, thank you. I didn't break a record, and I think I stopped before 12. That's probably a record for me.
By the way, you're welcome, everybody.
Thank you. Thanks for indulging.